No one would respect you, and you would not respect yourself. That ethic, of course, is self-regarding. You are focused on how the action will affect your honor and reputation. There is, however, another train of thought to take. You may imagine how much it would hurt to be mugged, and how the loss of money might harm people who depend on her. So you don't take the money, because you want the best for her and for her dependents. This is an other-regarding ethic. You are thinking completely about her. Over the years, Somerville found that the overwhelming majority of his students reasoned according to the second, other-regarding ethic. As a historian, he then showed them how Christian their moral orientation was. Christianity changed those honor-based cultures in which pride was valued rather than humility, dominance rather than service, courage rather than peaceableness, glory rather than modesty, loyalty to one's tribe rather than equal respect for all. The typical criticisms by secular people about the oppressiveness and injustices of the Christian church actually come from Christianity's own resources for critique of itself. The shortcomings of the church can be understood historically as the imperfect adoption and practice of the principles of the Christian gospel. Somerville says that when the Anglo-Saxons first heard the Christian gospel message, they were incredulous. They couldn't see how any society could survive that did not fear and respect strength. When they did convert, they were far from consistent. They tended to merge the Christian other-regarding ethic with their older ways. They supported the Crusades as a way of protecting God's honor and theirs. They let monks, women, and serfs cultivate charitable virtues, but these virtues weren't considered appropriate for men of honor and action. No wonder there is so much to condemn in church history. But to give up Christian standards would be to leave us with no basis for the criticism. What is the answer, then, to the very fair and devastating criticisms of the record of the Christian church? The answer is not to abandon the Christian faith, because that would leave us with neither the standards nor the resources to make correction. Instead, we should move to a fuller and deeper grasp of what Christianity is. The Bible itself has taught us to expect the abuses of religion, and it has also told us what to do about them. Because of this, Christian history gives us many remarkable examples of self-correction. Let's look at perhaps the two leading examples of this. A deep stain on Christian history is the African slave trade. Since Christianity was dominant in the nations that bought and sold slaves during that time, the churches must bear responsibility, along with their societies, for what happened. Even though slavery in some form was virtually universal in every human culture over the centuries, it was Christians who first came to the conclusion that it was wrong. Christians began to work for abolition not because of some general understanding of human rights, but because they saw it as violating the will of God. Older forms of indentured servanthood and the bond service of biblical times had often been harsh. But Christian abolitionists concluded that race-based, lifelong chattel slavery, established through kidnapping, could not be squared with biblical teaching either in the Old Testament or the New. Christian activists such as William Wilberforce in Great Britain, John Woolman in America, and many, many others, devoted their entire lives in the name of Christ to ending slavery. The slave trade was so tremendously lucrative that there was enormous incentive within the church to justify it. Many church leaders defended the institution. The battle for self-correction was titanic. When the abolitionists finally had British society poised to abolish slavery in their empire, planters in the colonies foretold that emancipation would cost investors enormous sums, and the prices of commodities would skyrocket catastrophically. This did not deter the abolitionists in the House of Commons. They agreed to compensate the planters for all freed slaves, an astounding sum up to half of the British government's annual budget. The Act of Emancipation passed in 1833, and the costs were so high to the British people that one historian called the British abolition of slavery voluntary econocide. The historian Rodney Stark notes how his colleagues have been desperately trying to figure out why the abolitionists were willing to sacrifice so much to end slavery. He quotes another historian, Howard Temperley, who says that the history of abolition is puzzling because most historians believe all political behavior is self-interested. Yet despite the fact that hundreds of scholars over the last 50 years have looked for ways to explain it, Temperley says, no one has succeeded in showing that those who campaigned for the end of the slave trade stood to gain in any tangible way, or that these measures were other than economically costly to the country. Slavery was abolished because it was wrong, and Christians were the leaders in saying so. Christianity's self-correcting apparatus, its critique of religiously supported acts of injustice, had asserted itself. Another classic case of this is the civil rights movement in the United States in the mid-20th century. When Martin Luther King Jr. confronted racism in the white church in the South, he did not call on Southern churches to become more secular. Read his sermons and letter from Birmingham jail, and see how he argued. He invoked God's moral law and the scripture. He called white Christians to be more true to their own beliefs and to realize what the Bible really teaches. He did not say, "Truth is relative and everyone is free to determine what is right or wrong for them." If everything is relative, there would have been no incentive for white people in the South to give up their power. Rather, Dr. King invoked the prophet Amos, who wrote, "Let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness as a mighty stream." The greatest champion of justice in our era knew the antidote to racism was not less Christianity, but a deeper and truer Christianity. Wilberforce and King were not, by any means, the only leaders who have turned the tide against injustice in the name of Christ. After apartheid was abolished in South Africa, everyone expected a bloodbath in which former victims would take violent vengeance on their persecutors and former oppressors would defend themselves with force. Instead, Christian leaders like Desmond Tutu set up the remarkable South African Commission for Truth and Reconciliation in the mid-1990s. Its name expressed its principle and mission. It invited victims to come forward to tell their stories publicly. It also invited former perpetrators of oppression and violence to come forward to tell the truth and ask for amnesty. No side was exempt from appearing before the commission. The commission heard reports of human rights violations and considered amnesty applications from all sides, from the former apartheid state, as well as from the African National Congress. Though not without its flaws and critics, the commission helped bring about the transition of majority rule with far less bloodshed than anyone could have expected. In the late 20th century, the Catholic Church in Eastern Europe refused to die under communism. Through patience, candles, and crosses, it began the chain of events that brought down all those totalitarian regimes. The Polish priest, Jerzy Popieluszko, through his preaching and activism, led the movement for a free trade union in communist Poland in the early 1980s. When he was murdered by the secret police, 250,000 people came to his funeral, including Lech Walesa, whose solidarity movement would help bring down the communist government. Many of those who went to his funeral marched past the secret police headquarters with a banner that read, "We forgive." The Christian underpinnings of the resistance movement were unmistakable. There is a long list of martyrs who stood up for the oppressed in Jesus' name, such as Archbishop Oscar Romero of El Salvador. Romero was made archbishop for his conservative Orthodox doctrinal views. In his new post, he saw irrefutable evidence of chronic and violent human rights abuses by the government. He began to speak out fearlessly against it, and as a result, he was shot to death in 1980 while saying Mass. Why mention all of these examples? They are evidence that Dr. King was right. When people have done injustice in the name of Christ, they are not being true to the spirit of the one who himself died as a victim of injustice and who called for the forgiveness of his enemies. When people give their lives to liberate others as Jesus did, they are realizing the true Christianity that Martin Luther King Jr. and other Christian voices have called for. Chapter 5. How can a loving God send people to hell? In 2005, Rick Warren, megachurch pastor and author of the best-selling book, The Purpose-Driven Life, spoke to leading journalists at a forum sponsored by the Pew Foundation. Some present were troubled by the civil implications of one particular Christian belief, namely that God consigns some people to eternal punishment. One speaker said to Warren, "Maybe you can hold in your mind the contradiction, which is that Wendy here, a non-Christian reporter, is a full American citizen, deserving of every protection that the most senior member of your church deserves. But when she dies, she's going to go to hell because she is not saved. The question is, do you think your followers, or the people who come to church, the people who read your books, the people you are talking to all over the world, are sophisticated enough to hold this contradiction in their minds? Warren responded that his church saw no contradiction between these things, but many of the journalists were unconvinced. They suggested that any Christian who thinks that there are people bound for hell must perceive such people as unequal in dignity and worth. In this, they reflected the deep misgivings of many today about the Christian concept of a God who judges people and sends them to hell. That belief, they contend, leads to exclusion, abuse, division, and even violence. In our culture, divine judgment is one of Christianity's most offensive doctrines. As a minister and preacher, I often find myself speaking on biblical texts that teach the wrath of God, the final judgment, and the doctrine of hell. For many years, I always held a question and answer session immediately after each service. There, I was regularly grilled by New Yorkers about these teachings. I found their deep distress over this aspect of historic Christian faith perfectly understandable. Although this objection to hell and judgment may seem to be more of a feeling of revulsion than a doubt, we still can find a number of very specific beliefs hidden inside it. Let's look at each one in turn. A God of judgment simply can't exist. Robert Bella's influential work, Habits of the Heart, speaks of the expressive individualism that dominates American culture. In his book, Bella notes that 80% of Americans agree with the statement, an individual should arrive at his or her own religious beliefs independent of any church or synagogue. He concludes that the most fundamental belief in American culture is that moral truth is relative to individual consciousness. Our culture, therefore, has no problem with a God of love who supports us no matter how we live. It does, however, object strongly to the idea of a God who punishes people for their sincerely held beliefs, even if they are mistaken. This objection, however, has a cultural history to it. In C.S. Lewis's classic, The Abolition of Man, he outlines what he considers to be a major difference between the ancient and modern views of reality. Lewis attacks our smug belief that ancient people believed in magic, and later modern science came along and supplanted it. As an expert in the medieval age and how it gave way to modernity, Lewis knew that there had been very little magic in the Middle Ages, that the high noon of magic was in the 16th and 17th centuries at the very time modern science was developing. The same cause, he contended, gave rise to them both. The serious magical endeavor and the serious scientific endeavor are twins. One was sickly and died. The other was strong and throve. But they are twins. They were born of the same impulse. Lewis describes that impulse, a new approach to moral and spiritual reality. He writes, "There is something which unites magic and applied science while separating both from the wisdom of earlier ages. For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality, and the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. And the solution is a technique. And both, in the practice of this technique, are ready to do things hitherto regarded as disgusting and impious." In ancient times, it was understood that there was a transcendent moral order outside the self, built into the fabric of the universe. If you violated that metaphysical order, there were consequences just as severe as if you violated physical reality by placing your hand in a fire. The path of wisdom was to learn to live in conformity with this unyielding reality. That wisdom rested largely in developing qualities of character such as humility, compassion, courage, discretion, and loyalty. Modernity reversed this. Ultimate reality was seen not so much as a supernatural order, but as the natural world, and that was malleable. Instead of trying to shape our desires to fit reality, we now seek to control and shape reality to fit our desires. The ancients looked at an anxious person and prescribed spiritual character change. Modernity talks instead about stress management techniques. Lewis knew that readers might think he was against the scientific method as such, but he protested that he was not. He wanted us to realize, however, that modernity was born in dreams of power. Writing during World War II, Lewis was standing in the midst of some of the bitterest fruit of the modern spirit. Lewis's friend, J.R.R. Tolkien, wrote The Lord of the Rings about the consequences of seeking power and control rather than wisdom and glad enjoyment of the givenness of God's creation. The spirit of modernity, then, gave us the responsibility to determine right or wrong. Our new confidence that we can control the physical environment has spilled over, so we now think we can reshape the metaphysical realm as well. It seems to our minds unfair, therefore, that we should determine that it is all right to have sex outside of marriage, and later discover that there is a God who is going to punish us for that. We believe so deeply in our personal rights in this realm that the very idea of a divine judgment day seems impossible. However, as Lewis shows us, this belief is tied to a quest for control and power that has had terrible consequences in recent world history. Not all the human race today has accepted modernity's view of things. Why should we act as if it is inescapable? In one of my after-service discussions, a woman told me that the very idea of a judging God was offensive. I said, "Why aren't you offended by the idea of a forgiving God?" She looked puzzled. I continued, "I respectfully urge you to consider your cultural location when you find Christian teaching about hell offensive." I went on to point out that secular Westerners get upset by the Christian doctrine of hell, but they find biblical teaching about turning the other cheek and forgiving enemies appealing. I then asked her to consider how someone from a very different culture sees Christianity. In traditional societies, the teaching about turning the other cheek makes absolutely no sense. It offends people's deepest instincts about what is right. For them, the doctrine of a God of judgment, however, is no problem at all. That society is repulsed by aspects of Christianity that Western people enjoy and are attracted by the aspects that secular Westerners can't stand. Why, I concluded, should Western cultural sensibilities be the final court in which to judge whether Christianity is valid? I asked the woman gently whether she thought her culture superior to non-Western ones. She immediately answered, "No." "Well, then," I asked, "why should your culture's objections to Christianity trump theirs?" For the sake of argument, let's imagine that Christianity is not the product of any one culture, but is actually the transcultural truth of God. If that were the case, we would expect that it would contradict and offend every human culture at some point, because human cultures are ever-changing and imperfect. If Christianity were the truth, it would have to be offending and correcting your thinking at some place. Maybe this is the place, the Christian doctrine of divine judgment. A God of judgment can't be a God of love. In Christianity, God is both a God of love and of justice. Many people struggle with this. They believe that a loving God can't be a judging God. Like most other Christian ministers in our society, I have been asked literally thousands of times, how can a God of love be also a God filled with wrath and anger? If he is loving and perfect, he should forgive and accept everyone. He shouldn't get angry. I always start my response by pointing out that all loving persons are sometimes filled with wrath, not just despite of, but because of their love. If you love a person and you see someone ruining them, even they themselves, you get angry. The Bible says that God's wrath flows from his love and delight in his creation. He is angry at evil and injustice because it is destroying its peace and integrity. Psalm 145 reads, "The Lord is righteous in all his ways and loving toward all he has made. The Lord watches over those who love him, but all the wicked he will destroy." It is at this point that many people complain that those who believe in a God of judgment will not approach enemies with a desire to reconcile with them. If you believe in a God who smites evildoers, you may think it perfectly justified to do some of the smiting yourself. Yale theologian Miroslav Volf, a Croatian who has seen the violence in the Balkans, does not see the doctrine of God's judgment that way. He writes, "If God were not angry at injustice and deception and did not make a final end to violence, that God would not be worthy of worship. The only means of prohibiting all recourse to violence by ourselves is to insist that violence is legitimate only when it comes from God." My thesis that the practice of nonviolence requires a belief in divine vengeance will be unpopular with many in the West. But it takes the quiet of a suburban home for the birth of the thesis that human nonviolence results from the belief in God's refusal to judge. In a sun-scorched land soaked in the blood of the innocent, it will invariably die with other pleasant captivities of the liberal mind. In this fascinating passage, Wolff reasons that it is the lack of belief in a God of vengeance that secretly nourishes violence. The human impulse to make perpetrators of violence pay for their crimes is almost an overwhelming one. It cannot possibly be overcome with platitudes like, "Now don't you see that violence won't solve anything?" If you have seen your home burned down and your relatives killed and raped, such talk is laughable, and it shows no real concern for justice. Yet victims of violence are drawn to go far beyond justice into the vengeance that says, "You put out one of my eyes, so I will put out both of yours." They are pulled inexorably into an endless cycle of vengeance, of strikes and counterstrikes, nurtured and justified by the memory of terrible wrongs. Can our passion for justice be honored in a way that does not nurture our desire for blood vengeance? Wolff says the only resource that can accomplish this is belief in the concept of God's divine justice. If I don't believe that there is a God who will eventually put things all right, I will take up the sword and will be sucked into the endless vortex of retaliation. Only if I am sure that there's a God who will right all wrongs and settle all accounts perfectly do I have the power to refrain. Many people complain that belief in a God of judgment will lead to a more brutal society. But if we are free to shape life and morals any way we choose without ultimate accountability, it can lead to violence. Wolff argues that the doctrine of God's final judgment is a necessary undergirding for the human practices of love and peacemaking. A loving God would not allow hell. Ah, you might say, fighting evil and injustice in the world is one thing, but sending people to hell is another. The Bible speaks of eternal punishment. How does that fit in with the love of God? I cannot reconcile even the idea of hell with a loving God. How do we address this understandable recoiling? Modern people inevitably think that hell works like this. God gives us time, but if we haven't made the right choices by the end of our lives, he casts our souls into hell for all eternity. As the poor souls fall through space, they cry out for mercy, but God says, "Too late. You had your chance. Now you will suffer." This caricature misunderstands the very nature of evil. The biblical picture is that sin separates us from the presence of God, which is the source of all joy and, indeed, of all love, wisdom, or good things of any sort. Since we were originally created for God's immediate presence, only before his face will we thrive, flourish, and achieve our highest potential. If we were to lose his presence totally, that would be hell, the loss of our capability for giving or receiving love or joy. A common image of hell in the Bible is that of fire. Fire disintegrates. Even in this life, we can see the kind of soul disintegration that self-centeredness creates. We know how selfishness and self-absorption lead to piercing bitterness, nauseating envy, paralyzing anxiety, paranoid thoughts, and the mental denials and distortions that accompany them. Now ask the question, what if when we die we don't end, but spiritually our life extends on into eternity? Hell, then, is the trajectory of a soul living a self-absorbed, self-centered life, going on and on forever. Jesus' parable of Lazarus and the rich man in the Gospel of Luke supports the view of hell we are presenting here. Lazarus is a poor man who begs at the gate of a cruel rich man. They both die, and Lazarus goes to heaven, while the rich man goes to hell. There he looks up and sees Lazarus in heaven in Abraham's bosom. So he called to him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, Remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us. He answered, Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have 5 brothers. Let him warn them, so that they will not also come to this place of torment. Abraham replied, They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. No, Father Abraham, he said, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent. And he said to him, If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead. What is astonishing is that, though their statuses have now been reversed, the rich man seems to be blind to what has happened. He still expects Lazarus to be his servant and treats him as his water boy. He does not ask to get out of hell, yet strongly implies that God never gave him and his family enough information about the afterlife. Commentators have noted the astonishing amount of denial, blame-shifting, and spiritual blindness in this soul in hell. They have also noted that the rich man, unlike Lazarus, is never given a personal name. He's only called a rich man, strongly hinting that since he had built his identity on his wealth rather than on God, once he lost his wealth, he lost any sense of a self. In short, hell is simply one's freely chosen identity apart from God on a trajectory into infinity. We see this process writ small in addictions to drugs, alcohol, gambling, and pornography. First, there is disintegration, because as time goes on, you need more and more of the addictive substance to get an equal kick, which leads to less and less satisfaction. Second, there is the isolation, as increasingly you blame others and circumstances in order to justify your behavior. No one understands. Everyone is against me, is muttered in greater and greater self-pity and self-absorption. When we build our lives on anything but God, that thing, though a good thing, becomes an enslaving addiction. Personal disintegration happens on a broader scale. In eternity, this disintegration goes on forever. There is increasing isolation, denial, delusion, and self-absorption. When you lose all humility, you are out of touch with reality. No one ever asks to leave hell. The very idea of heaven seems to them a sham. In his fantasy, The Great Divorce, C.S. Lewis describes a busload of people from hell who come to the outskirts of heaven. There, they are urged to leave behind the sins that have trapped them in hell, but they refuse. Lewis's descriptions of these people are striking because we recognize in them the self-delusion and self-absorption that are writ small in our own addictions. He writes, Hell begins with a grumbling mood, always complaining, always blaming others, but you are still distinct from it. You may even criticize it in yourself and wish you could stop it, but there may come a day when you can no longer. Then there will be no you left to criticize the mood or even to enjoy it, but just the grumble itself, going on forever like a machine. It is not a question of God sending us to hell. In each of us there is something growing which will be hell, unless it is nipped in the bud. The people in hell are miserable, but Lewis shows us why. We see raging like unchecked flames their pride, their paranoia, their self-pity, their certainty that everyone else is wrong, that everyone else is an idiot. All their humility is gone, and thus so is their sanity. They are utterly, finally, locked in a prison of their own self-centeredness, and their pride progressively expands into a bigger and bigger mushroom cloud. They continue to go to pieces forever, blaming everyone but themselves. Hell is that. Writ large. That is why it is a travesty to picture God casting people into a pit who are crying, I'm sorry, let me out. The people on the bus from hell in Lewis's parable would rather have their freedom, as they define it, than salvation. Their delusion is that if they glorified God, they would somehow lose power and freedom. But in a supreme and tragic irony, their choice has ruined their own potential for greatness. Hell is, as Lewis says, the greatest monument to human freedom. In Paul's epistle to the Romans, we read, God gave them up to their desires. All God does in the end with people is give them what they most want, including freedom from himself. What could be more fair than that? So Lewis writes, "There are only two kinds of people, those who say, 'Thy will be done' to God, or those to whom God in the end says, 'Thy will be done.' All that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice, it wouldn't be hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. I believe in a God of love. During my college years in my early 20s, I, like so many others, questioned the Christian faith I was raised in. There were subjective reasons for my doubts. Christianity didn't seem real to me experientially. I had not developed a prayer life and had never experienced God personally. There were also intellectual problems I was having with Christianity, all of which I am addressing elsewhere. There was one, however, I will talk about here. I was troubled by those Christians who stressed hellfire and damnation. Like so many of my generation, I believed that, if there was a core to all religions, it was a loving God. I wanted to believe in a God of love who accepted people regardless of their beliefs and practices. I began to take courses in the other major religions of the world, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, Confucianism, and Judaism. I have profited to this day from those studies. However, my explorations in other faiths proved me wrong on this particular point about the centrality of a loving God. I found no other religious text outside of the Bible that said God created the world out of love and delight. Most ancient pagan religions believed the world was created through struggles and violent battles between opposing gods and supernatural forces. I turned to look more closely at Buddhism, the religion I liked best at the time. However, despite its great emphasis on selflessness and detached service to others, Buddhism did not believe in a personal God at all, and love is the action of a person. Later on, after I became a minister, I was a speaker and panelist for several years in a monthly discussion program in Philadelphia between a Christian church and a mosque. Each month, a speaker from the church and a speaker from the mosque would give a biblical and Quranic perspective on some topic. When we covered the topic of God's love, it was striking how different our conceptions were. I was told repeatedly by Muslim speakers that God was indeed loving, in the sense of being merciful and kind to us. But when Christians spoke of the Lord as our spouse, of knowing God intimately and personally, and of having powerful effusions of his love poured into our hearts by the Holy Spirit, our Muslim friends balked. They told us that it was disrespectful, in their view, to speak of anyone knowing God personally. Today, many of the skeptics I talk to say, as I once did, they can't believe in the God of the Bible who punishes and judges people because they believe in a God of love. I now ask, what makes them think God is love? Can they look at life in the world today and say, this proves that the God of the world is a God of love? Can they look at history and say, this all shows that the God of history is a God of love? Can they look at the religious texts of the world and conclude that God is a God of love? By no means is that the dominant ruling attribute of God as understood in any of the major faiths. I must conclude that the source of the idea that God is love is the Bible itself. And the Bible tells us that the God of love is also a God of judgment, who will put all things in the world to rights in the end. The belief in a God of pure love, who accepts everyone and judges no one, is a powerful act of faith. Not only is there no evidence for it in the natural order, but there is almost no historical religious textual support for it outside of Christianity. The more one looks at it, the less justified it appears. Chapter 6. Science has disproved Christianity. The best-selling books by Richard Dawkins, Daniel C. Dennett, and Sam Harris assume that science in general, and evolutionary science in particular, has made belief in God unnecessary and obsolete. Dawkins said very famously that although atheism might have been logically tenable before Darwin, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. In The God Delusion, he goes much further. He argues that you cannot be an intelligent scientific thinker and still hold religious beliefs. It is one or the other. To support his thesis, he points out that a study in 1998 showed that only about 7% of American scientists in the National Academy of Sciences believe in a personal God. This is proof that the more intelligent, rational, and scientifically minded you are, the less you will be able to believe in God. Is Dawkins right? Has science essentially disproved Christian beliefs? Must we choose between thinking scientifically and belief in God? Aren't miracles scientifically impossible? The first reason that many people think science has disproved traditional religion is that most of the major faiths believe in miracles, the intervention of God into the natural order. The miraculous is particularly important for Christian belief. Christians annually celebrate the miracle of the Incarnation, the birth of Jesus, each Christmas, and the miracle of the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead, each Easter. The New Testament is filled with accounts of miracles that Jesus performed during the course of his ministry. Scientific mistrust of the Bible began with the Enlightenment belief that miracles cannot be reconciled to a modern, rational view of the world. Armed with this presupposition, scholars turned to the Bible and said, "The biblical accounts can't be reliable because they contain descriptions of miracles." The premise behind such a claim is, science has proven that there is no such thing as miracles. But embedded in such a statement is a leap of faith. It is one thing to say that science is only equipped to test for natural causes and cannot speak to any others. It is quite another to insist that science proves that no other causes could possibly exist. John Macquarie writes, "Science proceeds on the assumption that whatever events occur in the world can be accounted for in terms of other events just as imminent and this-worldly. So miracle is irreconcilable with our modern understanding of both science and history." Macquarie is quite right to assert that, when studying a phenomenon, the scientist must always assume there is a natural cause. That is because natural causes are the only kind its methodology can address. It is another thing to insist that science has proven there can't be any other kind. There would be no experimental model for testing the statement that no supernatural cause for any natural phenomenon is possible. It is therefore a philosophical presupposition and not a scientific finding. Macquarie's argument is ultimately circular. He says that science, by its nature, can't discern or test for supernatural causes, and therefore those causes can't exist. The philosopher Alvin Plantinga responds, "Macquarie perhaps means to suggest that the very practice of science requires that one reject the idea of God raising someone from the dead. This argument is like the drunk who insisted on looking for his lost car keys only under the streetlight on the grounds that the light was better there. In fact, it would go the drunk one better. It would insist that because the keys would be hard to find in the dark, they must be under the light." The other hidden premise in the statement, "miracles cannot happen," is there can't be a God who does miracles. If there is a creator God, there is nothing illogical at all about the possibility of miracles. After all, if he created everything out of nothing, it would hardly be a problem for him to rearrange parts of it as and when he wishes. To be sure that miracles cannot occur, you would have to be sure beyond a doubt that God didn't exist. And that is an article of faith. The existence of God can be neither demonstrably proven or disproven. Isn't science in conflict with Christianity? It is common to believe today that there is a warfare going on between science and religion. One of the reasons for this perception is that the media needs to report news events as stories with protagonists and antagonists. It gives wide publicity to battles between secular and religious people over the teaching of evolution in schools, stem cell research, in vitro fertilization, and many other areas of medicine and science. These battles give credibility to the claims of Dawkins, Harris, and others that it is either or. You can be either scientific and rational or religious. Over the years at Redeemer, I've talked to many people trained in science and biology who were very wary of Orthodox Christian belief. One young medical student said to me, "The Bible denies evolution, which most educated people accept. It bothers me terribly that so many Christians, because of their belief in the Bible, can take such an unscientific mindset." His concern is quite understandable. Here's how I responded to him. Evolutionary science assumes that more complex life forms evolve from less complex forms through a process of natural selection. Many Christians believe that God brought about life this way. For example, the Catholic Church, the largest church in the world, has made official pronouncements supporting evolution as being compatible with Christian belief. However, Christians may believe in evolution as a process without believing in philosophical naturalism, the view that everything has a natural cause, and that organic life is solely the product of random forces guided by no one. When evolution is turned into an all-encompassing theory, explaining absolutely everything we believe, feel, and do as the product of natural selection, then we are not in the arena of science, but of philosophy. Evolution as an all-encompassing theory has insurmountable difficulties as a worldview. We will look at these difficulties in Chapter 9. Dawkins argues that if you believe in evolution as a biological mechanism, you must also believe in philosophical naturalism. But why? The same year that Dawkins' The God Delusion was published, Francis Collins published The Language of God. Collins is an eminent research scientist and head of the Human Genome Project. He believes in evolutionary science and critiques the intelligent design movement that denies the transmutation of species. However, Collins believes that the fine-tuning, beauty, and order of nature nonetheless point to a divine creator and describes his conversion from atheism to Christianity. Here, then, is what Dawkins says can exist. Someone with a firm belief in evolution as biological mechanism, but who completely rejects philosophical naturalism. Collins, of course, is not alone. Contrary to Dawkins' simplistic schema, there are many different models proposed about how God relates to the development of life forms we see today. Ian Barber lays out four different ways that science and religion may be related to one another: conflict, dialogue, integration, and independence. At the one end of the spectrum, in conflict, are both the proponents of creation science and, ironically, thinkers like Dawkins. Each side has bought into the warfare model of the relationship of science to faith. Many creationists' view of Genesis chapter 1 makes any kind of evolutionary process impossible, while the philosophical naturalism of Dawkins makes religious belief totally invalid. At the other end of the spectrum, there are those who believe faith is mainly a private, subjective thing, and therefore does not speak to the empirical realm at all. In this view, science and religion have nothing to say to one another at all. Barber himself thinks this view gives away too much, and prefers the spectrum of more moderate and complicated approaches in which science and religious faith recognize their respective spheres of authority. It is the conflict model, however, that gets the most publicity. Fortunately, this view is losing credibility with a growing number of scientists. The history of the secularization of American institutions is treated in an important and influential book edited by Christian Smith. In it, Smith argues that the conflict model of the relationship of science to religion was a deliberate exaggeration used by both scientists and educational leaders at the end of the 19th century to undermine the church's control of their institutions and increase their own cultural power. The absolute warfare model of science and reason was the product not so much of intellectual necessity, but rather of a particular cultural strategy. Many scientists see no incompatibility between faith in God and their work. Two famous studies that support this contention were done in 1916 and 1997. The American psychologist James Luba conducted the first survey of scientists, asking them if they believed in a God who actively communicates with humanity, at least through prayer. 40% said they did, 40% said they did not, and 20% were not sure. In 1997, Edward Larson and Larry Widom repeated the survey, asking the very same questions of scientists. They reported in the scientific journal Nature that they had found that the numbers had not changed significantly in 80 years. What then of Dawkins' claim that nearly all prominent scientists disbelieve in God? In The God Delusion, he cites Larson and Widom's follow-up correspondence in Nature a year later. There they noted that when they asked the same question about belief in God to members of the National Academy of Sciences, only 7% said yes. Dawkins cites this figure as evidence that intelligent scientific thinking almost always leads to the conclusion that God does not exist. There are, however, major problems with the way Dawkins and even Larson and Widom interpret the data from these studies. First, keep in mind the original question posed to the scientists in both surveys. Scientists were asked if they believe in a God who personally communicates with humanity. To hold that a transcendent God created the universe is not enough to be listed as a believer. Any NAS scientist who believes in a God who does not communicate directly with humanity is automatically put into the category of disbeliever. The surveys were only designed to see scientists with conservative traditional belief. Those with a more general belief in God are screened out by the way the question is formulated. Second, Dawkins reads the data as establishing a causal relationship between the scientific mind and atheism. His assumption is that NAS scientists disbelieve because they are scientifically minded. However, the study does not and cannot prove what the cause of NAS scientists' disbelief in God really is. Alistair McGrath, a theologian with an Oxford doctorate in biophysics, writes that most of the many unbelieving scientists that he knows are atheists on other grounds than their science. Many complex factors lead a person to belief or disbelief in God. Some are personal experiences, some are intellectual, and others are social. Sociologists of knowledge like Peter Berger have shown that our peer group and primary relationships shape our beliefs much more than we want to admit. Scientists, like non-scientists, are very affected by the beliefs and attitudes of the people from whom they want respect. In McGrath's experience, most of his atheist colleagues brought their assumptions about God to their science rather than basing them on their science. Also, Dawkins gives readers the impression that all atheistic scientists would agree with him that no rational scientific mind could believe in God, but that is simply not the case. Stephen Jay Gould, the late Harvard scientist and evolutionist who was himself an atheist, knew all about these studies, but could not conclude with Dawkins that science necessarily clashed with Christian faith. He wrote, "Either half my colleagues are enormously stupid, or else the science of Darwinism is fully compatible with conventional religious beliefs, and equally compatible with atheism." When Gould spoke of half his colleagues, he was probably not thinking strictly of survey data. He simply knew that a great number of his most respected scientific colleagues had traditional religious beliefs about God. One of the reasons Gould does not agree with Dawkins is that he was much more willing to concede that science might not be able to account for everything about human existence to every thinker's satisfaction. Another scholar who makes this point is the philosopher Thomas Nagel, who critiqued Dawkins' approach in a review of the God Delusion in the journal The New Republic. Nagel, too, is an atheist, but writes, "Dawkins is wrong to insist that if we are going to be scientific at all, we must embrace physicalist naturalism, that the ultimate explanation of everything must lie in particle physics, string theory, or whatever purely extensional laws govern the elements of which the material world is composed." He asks, for example, whether we really believe that our moral intuitions, such as that genocide is morally wrong, are not real, but only the result of neurochemistry hardwired into us. Can physical science do full justice to reality as human beings experience it? Nagel doubts that, and he writes, "The reductionist project usually tries to reclaim some of the originally excluded aspects of the world by analyzing them in physical, that is, behavioral or neurophysiological, terms, but it denies reality to what cannot be so reduced. I believe the project is doomed, that conscious experience, thought, value, and so forth are not illusions, even though they cannot be identified with physical facts." This is why even many atheists believe Dawkins is wrong, that science cannot explain everything, and why scientific thought can be compatible with religious belief. Even though the concept of warfare between science versus religion still has much popular credence, we should disabuse ourselves of the notion that we have to choose between the two, or that if you want to be a Christian, you will have to be in conflict with science. A majority of scientists consider themselves deeply or moderately religious, and those numbers have increased in recent decades. There is no necessary disjunction between science and devout faith. Doesn't evolution disprove the Bible? What about the more specific issue of how evolutionary science fits with the biblical account of creation in Genesis chapter 1 and 2? Surely there we have a head-on collision. No, That's not the case. Different Christian thinkers use all of Barber's models of relating science to faith: conflict, dialogue, integration, and independence. Some Christians in the highly publicized creation science movement take the conflict model and insist that Genesis chapter 1 teaches that God created all life forms in a period of 6 24-hour days just several thousand years ago. At the other end of the spectrum are Christians who take the independence model and simply say God was the primary cause in beginning the world, and after that, natural causes take over. Other thinkers occupy the central positions. Some hold that God created life and then guided natural selection to develop all complex life forms from simpler ones. In this view, God acts as the top-down cause without violating the process of evolution. Others, believing there are gaps in the fossil record and claiming that species seem to appear rather than develop from simpler forms, believe that God performed large-scale creative acts at different points over longer periods of time. The relationship of science to the Bible hinges not only on how we read the scientific record, but how we interpret certain key biblical passages such as Genesis chapter 1. Christians who accept the Bible's authority agree that the primary goal of biblical interpretation is to discover the biblical author's original meaning as he sought to be understood by his audience. This has always meant interpreting a text according to its literary genre. For example, when Christians read the Psalms, they read it as poetry. When they read the Gospel of Luke, which claims to be an eyewitness account, they take it as history. Any reader can see that the historical narrative should be read as history, and that the poetic imagery is to be read as metaphorical. The difficulty comes in the few places in the Bible where the genre is not easily identifiable, and we aren't completely sure how the author expects it to be read. Genesis chapter 1 is a passage whose interpretation is up for debate among Christians, even those with a high view of inspired scripture. I personally take the view that Genesis chapters 1 and 2 relate to one another the way Judges chapters 4 and 5 and Exodus chapters 14 and 15 do. In each couplet, one chapter describes a historical event, and the other is a song or poem about the theological meaning of the event. When reading Judges 4, it is obvious that it is a sober recounting of what happened in the battle. But when we read Judges 5, Deborah's song about the battle, the language is poetic and metaphorical. When Deborah sings that the stars in the heavens came down to fight for the Israelites, we understand that she means that metaphorically. I think Genesis chapter 1 has the earmarks of poetry, and is therefore a song about the wonder and meaning of God's creation. Genesis chapter 2 is an account of how it happened. There will always be debates about how to interpret some passages, including Genesis 1. But it is false logic to argue that if one part of Scripture can't be taken literally, then none of it can. That isn't true of any human communication. What can we conclude? Since Christian believers occupy different positions on both the meaning of Genesis 1 and on the nature of evolution, those who are considering Christianity as a whole should not allow themselves to be distracted by this intramural debate. The skeptical inquirer does not need to accept any one of these positions in order to embrace the Christian faith. Rather, he or she should concentrate on and weigh the central claims of Christianity. Only after drawing conclusions about the person of Christ, the resurrection, and the central tenets of the Christian message should one think through the various options with regard to creation and evolution. Representatives of these different views often imply that their approach is the one true Christian position on evolution. Indeed, I'm sure that many listening to this will be irritated that I don't take time here to adjudicate between these competing views. For the record, I think God guided some kind of process of natural selection, and yet I reject the concept of evolution as all-encompassing theory. Here's how one commentator on Genesis describes the balance. If evolution is elevated to the status of a worldview, of the way things are, then there is direct conflict with biblical faith. But if evolution remains at the level of scientific biological hypothesis, it would seem that there is little reason for conflict between the implications of Christian belief in the Creator and the scientific explorations of the way which, at the level of biology, God has gone about his creating processes. Chapter 7. You can't take the Bible literally. When I was in college in the late 1960s, I took some courses on the Bible as literature and was confronted with the prevailing wisdom of the time. My professors taught that the New Testament Gospels originated as the oral traditions of various church communities around the Mediterranean. These stories about Jesus were shaped by those communities to address the questions and needs peculiar to each church. Leaders made certain that the Jesus in these stories supported the policies and beliefs of their communities. The oral traditions were then passed down over the years, evolving through the addition of various legendary materials. Finally, long after the actual events, the Gospels assumed written form. By then, it was almost impossible to know to what degree, if any, they represented the actual historical events. Who then was the original Jesus? The scholars I read proposed that the real historical Jesus was a charismatic teacher of justice and wisdom who provoked opposition and was then executed. After his death, they said, different parties and viewpoints emerged among his followers about who he was. Some claimed he was divine and risen from the dead. Others that he was just a human teacher who lived on spiritually in the hearts of his disciples. After a power struggle, the divine Jesus party won and created texts that promoted its views. They allegedly suppressed and destroyed all the alternative texts showing us a different sort of Jesus. Recently, some of these suppressed alternate views of Jesus have come to light, like the Gnostic Gospels of Thomas and Judas. This shows, it is said, that early Christianity was very diverse in its doctrinal beliefs. If this view of the New Testament's origins and development is true, it would radically change our understanding of the content and meaning of Christianity itself. It would mean that no one could really know what Jesus said and did, and that the Bible could not be the authoritative norm over our life and beliefs. It would mean that most of the classic Christian teaching, Jesus' deity, atonement, and resurrection, are mistaken and based on legends. The Christian faith requires belief in the Bible. This is a big stumbling block for many. I meet many New Yorkers for the first time after they have been invited to one of Redeemer's services. The centerpiece of each service is a sermon based on a text of the Bible. The average visitor is surprised or even shocked to find us listening to the Bible so carefully. Most would say that they know there are many great stories and sayings in the Bible, but today you can't take it literally. What they mean is that the Bible is not entirely trustworthy because some parts, maybe many or most parts,